Well, it's almost football season, isn't it? The late Johnny Unitas has been called the best quarterback ever, but his way into the NFL was not easy. The struggle started early for Unitas. When he was 5, his father died. His mother had to work 2 jobs to support the family. And Johnny was a little scrawny kid trying to play football. He made the high school football team, but he sat on the bench. Johnny only became a quarterback when the first stringer broke his ankle. And when Johnny then went on to he just wanted to play football in college, he was rejected by the University of Notre Dame. He was offered a scholarship from the University of Pittsburgh, but he failed the entrance exam, so he couldn't go there. He wound up playing for the University of Louisville, and he wasn't even drafted until the 9th round by the Pittsburgh Steelers. But Johnny didn't even make it in the regular season. They cut him before the season started. He was forced to find work in construction, play semi-pro football. Then the Baltimore Colts received a letter from a fan telling them about a player that was deserving of a chance. The Colts gave Unitas a $7,000 a year contract. Imagine that. But he had to play the whole year to earn it. When Johnny was put in for the Colts, his first pass was intercepted. He dropped the ball on the very next 2 plays that he had it. But Unitas persevered, and he ultimately led the Colts for 17 years and won 3 championships. And he has twice been voted as the best quarterback in NFL history. All right, we love stories like that. Stories about overcomers. People who overcome great odds and struggles to make it in life. Well, I want to tell you that the book of Revelation is all about overcomers. It is one of the grand themes of the book. And in Revelation chapter 15, where we pick up this morning, we see God bringing his final lawsuit against the powers of this world and vindicating his overcomers who have been faithful to him to persevere through life. God's last lawsuit vindicates his overcomers. Revelation chapter 15, verse 1. "And I saw another sign in heaven," John writes, "great and marvelous, 7 angels who had 7 plagues, which are the last, because in them the wrath of God is completed." Now this is the third sign that John sees in the heavens. The woman and the dragon of Revelation 12 were the first 2 signs. Now John sees 7 angels who have the 7 plagues to be poured out on earth. The 7 plagues, of course, remind us of the Exodus when God delivered his people Israel from the power of the Egyptian Pharaoh. God sent plagues on the Egyptians and he delivered his people. So the same theme can be seen here in the book of Revelation. In Revelation, God sends plagues, but the plagues are both a judgment on those who fight God and a form of deliverance, or the means of deliverance for those who are following God. God tells John that these are the last of the plagues because in them the wrath of God is completed. It is finished. It is filled up. It is fulfilled. Now back in Revelation chapter 6, you remember that the martyrs cried out to God, those who had given their life for their faith in Christ, cried out to God, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging this world?" God told them in Revelation 6 to what? Be patient. There was a delay before God finally judged this world. And in Revelation chapter 10 in verses 6 and 7, God says, "There will now no longer be any more delay in the judgment." And he tells John in Revelation 10 that in the days when the 7th trumpet sounds, then the mystery of God is finished, completed, same Greek word, fulfilled just as he predicted by his prophets in the Old Testament. So the seventh angel has sounded, Revelation 11, verse 15. And now God sends his last judgment upon the earth in chapter 15. Just as God predicted by his prophets in the Old Testament and through John in the New Testament. And God is just. He will judge this world one day. And his final lawsuit then against this world will prove his justice and it will vindicate his followers. Principle number one this morning. Those who follow God celebrate his greatness. Verses 2-4. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mixed with fire, and those who had come off victorious from the beast and from his image and from the number of his name, standing on the sea of glass, holding harps of God. And they sang the song of Moses, the bondservant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, Great and marvelous are thy works, O Lord God the Almighty. Righteous and true are thy ways, thou King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou alone art holy. For all the nations will come and worship before thee, for thy righteous acts have been revealed. So the first thing that John sees is a glassy sea mixed with fire. The glassy sea represents the heavenly throne room, temple, the temple of God in heaven. We know that from Revelation chapter 4 and verse 6, where the glassy sea stretched out from the throne of heaven. But here the glassy sea is mixed with fire. Fire is the symbol of God's judgment in the book of Revelation. God's judgment is either a purifying judgment or a purging judgment. It is either purifying or purging. For those who are followers of God, the judgment purifies them for eternity. For those who are against God, the judgment purges them from eternal life with God. God is purifying this earth through judgment, and he is purging this earth of all who stand against him, so that in the end, all the nations of this world will worship God. I like what pastor and author Warren Wiersbe wrote. A realist is an idealist who has gone through the fire and been purified. A skeptic is an idealist who has gone through the fire and been burned. John sees a crowd of people who have gone through the fire and they have been purified here. And he calls these people the ones who are conquering, who are being victorious. These are the conquerors. The word is our familiar word in the book of Revelation for overcomer. These are the overcomers. Now, in Revelation 15, we have arrived at the end. We are looking ahead to heaven, essentially, to the new world. And all of God's overcomers are celebrating his greatness together. These are the men and the women who have been faithful to God through the tribulation period. These are the men and the women who have refused to surrender to the powers and influences of this world. They have stood for the Lamb, even to the point of death. Now they receive their great reward in heaven. The overcomer theme is one of the great themes of the book of Revelation. Over and over and over again, we see this Greek word for overcomer or conqueror. The letters to the seven churches in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, each letter to each church had a promise to an overcomer. Those who were overcomers in that church, God made a specific promise to in each of the letters to the seven churches of Asia Minor. And the Greek word is the same word. It is the word for being victorious or overcoming or conquering. In Revelation chapter 3, verse 12, Christ said, He who overcomes or conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. And I will write upon him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and my new name. That's God's promise to the overcomer in Revelation 3. And when we get to the end of the book of Revelation, and we get to the New Jerusalem, God tells us about all the wonders of this life that he promises to those who overcome or conquer this world system. And he says in Revelation 21, verse 7, he who overcomes or conquers shall inherit these things. And I will be his God, and he will be my son. And it's a great passage where we use it often in funerals because he wipes away the tears from everyone's eyes. They are more than conquerors. They are overcomers. Here in Revelation 15, we're told the challenges that the overcomers must face. They conquer three challenges, God says here in Revelation 15. First, they conquer the beast. Second, the image. And third, the number of his name. The beast, of course, is the political ruler of Satan's world. So the first pressure that Christians face is a political pressure. Overcomers do not surrender to the political pressure that they face in the end times. They overcome it. Second, the image represents religious pressure. You remember in our study that the second beast there is a religious leader who tries to force the entire world to worship the first beast in Satan's kingdom. So this is religious pressure that is brought on people. So the second pressure that Christians face and have to overcome is religious pressure. Third, the number of the beast's name is 666. And that number, you remember, becomes necessary to buy or sell in the global economy. So the third pressure that overcomers face is economic pressure. Now, the believers of John's day at the end of the first century in Asia Minor, the churches that he was writing to in what would be modern-day Turkey, all faced these same pressures. They faced political pressure, because emperor worship was the way to go in that day, and you had to worship the Caesar, the Almighty One. They faced religious pressure because you had to belong to the temple in that city, and you had to go and worship in that temple. Otherwise, you were persecuted. And they faced economic pressure because you had to belong to the guilds or the unions, if you will, of those cities. And they all forced you to worship in the temple. Otherwise, you couldn't get a job. So they faced political pressure, religious pressure, and economic pressure. Christians down through the ages, these are the classic techniques or methods of Satan, are they not? He is always using these kinds of tools to force people into his mold in this world. Political pressure, religious pressure, and economic pressure. And Christians today all over this globe face those same kinds of pressures in varying degrees. And we must face up to these pressures. And God says those who follow him are overcomers. They overcome or conquer these pressures. Now, we don't do it in our own strength. We do it in the strength of God, in the strength of Jesus Christ, the blood of the Lamb, in the name of Christ. But we overcome to enjoy the overcomer's reward forever as a follower of Christ. What pressures do you face? God calls you to be faithful and to be an overcomer every day. Hear the parable of the overcomer and learn its lessons in life. An old dog fell into a farmer's well. After assessing the situation, the farmer decided that the old dog was not worth saving, and neither was the well. And so he decided to bury the dog and fill in the well at the same time. And he began shoveling dirt into the well. The dog at the bottom of the well was hysterical. The shovels of dirt were coming down upon him. He thought it was all over. And he shook some of it off. And then he shook some more off, and then he had a thought. And each shovelful, he would shake it off and step up. And he said to himself, shake it off and step up. And so shovel by shovel came into that well. And he shook it off and he stepped up until he stepped out of the well and was saved. What seemed as though it would bury him benefited him because of how he handled it. Well, the parable of the overcomer. God's overcomers know that principle. What is the principle of the overcomer? Shake it off and step up. Say it with me. Shake it off and step up every day. Thank you, Gene. I like it when somebody follows instructions right to the T. That's great. Yeah, shake it off, step up. It's the way to win in the end. So the overcomers have won in the end here in Revelation 15. And they sing a song of praise to God. And that song is the song of Moses and it is the song of the Lamb. It's not two different songs, but one and the same song. Old Testament believers, New Testament believers ultimately sing the same song, the song of Moses and the song of the Lamb, are one and the same song of praise to God. And the song celebrates God's rightness. It vindicates God's justice in all that he does. Unbelievers often rail against God's justice. They scream that God is unfair. Perhaps you've even heard that. That God has no right to do what he does, that God has no right to judge them. Believers know that when God judges, he judges fairly always. So you can tell a person's heart by how they respond to God's judgment. So believers in this song sing that God is vast and excellent. First of all, in his works, in everything he does, God is huge. He does so much, and he is excellent in everything that God does. The way God goes about managing things is good. He is ruler of all, the song says. He is the Greek word is pantokrator, which was a term that the Caesars used for themselves. They called themselves the Pantocrator, the Almighty One. God says, I'm the Almighty One. And we sing that he is the Almighty One. Second, they sing, lawful and just, truthful are your ways. The way God goes about managing this world is always just. It is always lawful. And it is always true. Can you say that when you look around at this world? The only way is by faith right now, isn't it? That God is always, in everything he does and the way he does it, God is always just and true. That's a statement of faith we make now. Thirdly, all the nations of this world will fear and glorify God in worship. That's a prediction we often saw in the Old Testament prophets. And one day it will come true as God purges this world of unbelievers through his judgment. Now we worship God because he is holy and because his indictments are true. The phrase righteous acts here says righteous acts have been revealed. Literally, it means his indictments have been revealed. An indictment is the accusation that you bring against someone in a court of law. God's indictments have now been revealed at this point. And we now understand, at the point of Revelation 15, that everything God does in judgment is best. It is true. it is right. It's very easy today to question God's judgment at times, isn't it? But then we will know that every judgment of God is absolutely perfectly just. This is what we call a theodicy. A theodicy is just a big word to say that God vindicates his justice, that he is absolutely right in what he does. We question God now, but God will prove his absolute rightness one day. That's a theodicy. He is defending his rightness to do what he does. The overcomers know that God is right and good and true in all that he does. And so today, as a statement of faith, going through the tough times, we need to know that what God does is always best and good and true and just. Those who follow God celebrate his greatness by faith. But secondly, verses 5 through 8, those who fight God face his judgment. Donald Drusky took God to court. The one-time employee of USX Corporation blamed God for failing to rectify the wrong done to him when he was fired by the corporation in 1968. Drusky waged a 30-year battle with the steelmaker before finally deciding to take legal action against God. The suit read, "The defendant, God, is the sovereign ruler of the universe and took no corrective action against the leaders of this church and his nation for their extremely serious wrongs which ruined the life of Donald S. Drusky." For damages, Drusky asked for the return of his youth, the skill of a great guitarist, and the resurrections of his mother and pet pigeon. This is really true. Drusky hoped that God would fail to appear in court that day, allowing him to win the case by default. Well, Drusky's case was declared frivolous and thrown out by a Syracuse court in 2004, thankfully. But everyone seems to want to put God on trial. C.S. Lewis wrote a very well-known book a number of years ago called God in the Dock, built upon the British system where the defendant stood in the dock, in the place where the accused stands in the courtroom. And he said in that book that everyone wants to put God on trial. They want God in the dock, and man is his judge. And isn't that the way? People want to stand in judgment on God, and God's in the dock, and God will be judged, and we're going to straighten God out for all the stuff that he didn't do, or he did do and we didn't like. All of the injustices of our lives, God's to blame. Well, there's coming a day when heaven's courtroom will be opened, but God won't be the defendant. He'll be the judge. And all who fight God will face his judgment in that day. Verse 5. "And after these things I looked, and the temple of the tabernacle of testimony in heaven was opened, and the seven angels who had the seven plagues came out of the temple, clothed in linen, clean and bright, and girded around their breasts with golden girdles. And one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God, who lives forever and ever. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no one was able to enter the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels were finished." John sees seven angels coming out of the temple in heaven. They're dressed in bright linen garments with a golden sash around their chests. Now, this is the only place in the book of Revelation where this particular Greek word for the garment is used. Other places for these angels wear bright white garments, a different Greek word is used. This is the only place where this one is used. And this is the Greek word that is used in the Old Testament, Greek translation of the Old Testament, to refer to the garments of the priests in the temple or the tabernacle in the Old Testament. And he goes all the way back, by the way, to the imagery of the tabernacle here. So this is the clothing of the priests. This is then a priestly function. These angels are about to perform a priestly function in judging this world, in purifying this world system, this earth. The angels carry the seven plagues to be inflicted on earth's residents. Now, the judgments in Revelation are often called plagues over and over again. And there is a strong correlation between these plagues and the plagues that God inflicted on Egypt in order to release his people Israel from slavery. We have already seen that the overcomers sing the song of Moses, which is a reference back to Exodus chapter 15, and the song that was sung after God delivered the people of Israel from the Red Sea. And Pharaoh and his army were destroyed in the Red Sea. They sang the song of Moses in Exodus 15, celebrating God's deliverance. The language of Revelation 15:4 is very similar to the language of Exodus chapter 15 and verse 11. And we also remember that the Passover lamb of Exodus 12 was a very important part of that. And we have been learning of the song of the lamb in Revelation. And finally, there is a direct connection between the plagues of Egypt and these final plagues listed in Revelation 16, which we will look at next Sunday. In Egypt, God turned the water into blood. And in Revelation 16, God will turn the water into blood. In Egypt, God caused painful sores to develop on the Egyptians. And in Revelation 16, God will cause painful sores to develop on those who enslave his people. In Egypt, God caused hail to fall on this world. And in Revelation 16, God will cause hail to fall on this world that is very destructive. And in Exodus chapter 10, in the plagues, God caused darkness to fall upon the land of Egypt. And in Revelation chapter 16, God will cause darkness to fall upon this world. Now, we know from our study of Exodus, if you can think back that far, I guess it's been a few years since we went through Exodus, that God was in a battle with the gods of Egypt in Exodus. You remember that? Nod your heads all you. You got to humor me this morning, you know. God in the book of Exodus, those plagues were all designed to attack the gods of Egypt. Each different god had different controls over this world. And so God was in a battle with the gods of Egypt for the release of his people from their slavery. In Revelation, I said many times before already, this is a spiritual warfare book. God is in a battle with the kingdom of Satan in the book of Revelation. And he is in a battle with the kingdom of Satan to release his people from slavery in this world. So the judgments are the means of release, just as they were in Exodus. And there is a conscious connection between the two. And any Jewish believer such as John would have clearly seen that connection. God is saying to Satan in the book of Revelation, "Let my people go. This world is mine." Satan, you see, is the usurper. He is the one who has come and taken over what God created. And God is saying in the book of Revelation, at the end of this age, "I am coming back and you will let my people go. And I will purge this world. And I will purify it. And I will release my people from the oppression and slavery of this world system." And who are God's people in the book of Revelation? They are the overcomers, the ones who are faithful to God. Now John sees one of the four living creatures with the six wings. These living creatures, you remember, surround the very throne of God in Revelation chapter 4. This particular living creature gives each of the seven angels a golden bowl, which is filled to the brim with the wrath of God. The word used here refers to a large saucer-shaped bowl or pan, and these kinds of pans were used in the tabernacle of the Old Testament. In the tabernacle, there were golden saucers or pans that were used in the holy place, placed on the table of showbread, and they were used to carry incense and other purification activities in the worship of God. Golden pans were also used to empty the blood from the burnt sacrifices on the altar and to pour that blood around. So, once again, God's judgments are a priestly function designed to purify His world. And in the book of Revelation, we have seen these golden bowls before. They were carried by the 24 elders back in Revelation chapter 5. And at that time, the bowls were filled with the prayers of the saints, not the wrath of God. Back in Revelation 5, the pans are filled with the prayers of the saints before God. And then in Revelation 8, the altar of incense symbolized the prayers of the saints as well. And the censer from that altar of incense, which contained the prayers of the saints on earth, was used to judge the earth as God judged the earth for its oppression of His people. So I think the golden bowls of judgment link the prayers of the saints on earth for vindication with the answer from God to those prayers. You wonder if God ever hears those prayers? He does. And He will answer one day. When this world system oppresses God's people, and God's people cry out to God to do something, God hears those prayers. And God will vindicate His people. The world will one day know that we were right. They were wrong, for we have chosen to follow God, and it may not look like a good choice today for many. But in that day, we will be vindicated and our prayers will be answered. Justice will prevail in God's final judgment of this world as God answers the prayers of the saints down through history. We are now introduced to the third tour of the tribulation period. You remember, we have covered there are three sets of seven judgments. Just to quickly rehearse this, there are the seven seal judgments. There are the seven trumpet judgments. We have already worked our way through the seven seal judgments and the seven trumpet judgments. And then we come to the seven bowl judgments in the book of Revelation. I think that these are all three sets of judgments that overlap one another and emphasize in different ways what God is doing during what we call the tribulation period or the 70th week of Daniel. I say that partially because of the similarities between the judgments. In this slide, you can see just a comparison of the trumpets and the bowls, for example, that the trumpet judgments include the ocean turned to blood, fresh water polluted, and sun, moon, and stars darkened. And the bowl judgments include the ocean turned to blood, fresh water turned to blood, and darkness in the kingdom of the beast. So the same three judgments are included in the bowl judgments as in the trumpet judgments. So I think these are overlapping judgments. They are tours of the tribulation period. And I think we are now in our final tour with our final tour guide through this period of judgment. So it's natural that we'd see some similarities and add some new information. This third tour, however, is unlike the first two tours in that the first two had an interlude in between and the third tour does not. It goes straight from the sixth to the seventh judgment. And then after the seventh judgment, there's a brief set of information about some of those judgments, some additional information, and we go straight into the return of Christ. So this is God's final word on the judgments that He will inflict on earth. He will purge this world of sin. He will set up His kingdom because Christ is coming back at the end of this. The temple is now filled with smoke from the glory of God, from His power. In the Old Testament, smoke was often the symbol of God's powerful, holy presence, especially in judgment. And no one is allowed into this heavenly temple until these judgments are completed. God will finish his purifying without interruption. We have reached the point of no return for this world. This world does reach a point of no return. God is long-suffering, not willing that any should perish. But at some point, the world reaches the point of no return. And God no longer listens to the prayers for mercy and the pleas for delay. There will be no more delay. God has waited long enough, and he will judge this world. And those who fight God will face his judgment. That's why God leaves us now with the mandate to be warning and sharing with our loved ones, with our neighbors, with our co-workers, with people in Peru and people in Gorham. For they need to know that God will judge this world one day. And only those who are faithful to him in this life, by the blood of the Lamb, overcome. Following Sunday worship services, January 8th, 2006, year and a half ago, five young men attacked and threatened to kill a Protestant church leader in Turkey's fourth largest city. Remember, John wrote to the churches of what is today Turkey in the book of Revelation. Kamil Kirglu, age 29, had just left his church in Adana when he was ambushed and beaten so severely that he fell unconscious twice. "They were trying to force me to deny Jesus," he said. "But each time they asked me to deny Jesus and become a Muslim, I was saying, 'Jesus is Lord.' The more I said, 'Jesus is Lord,' the more they beat me." One of the attackers pulled out a long butcher knife and threatened to kill Kiroglu if he did not deny his Christian faith and return to Islam. He refused. After the incident, he said, "I am praising God, not because he saved me from death, but because he helped me not to deny him in the shadow of death." The world stands against Christ today. It always has stood against Christ. Many Christians suffer for their faith and have suffered for their faith down through the centuries. All of that will come to a head at the end of the age when the world's armies gather to fight the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And we're almost to that point in the book of Revelation. He will destroy them in that day. But until then, God calls us to be faithful to him. He calls us to not deny him, even under the pressure of death. Faithfulness, that is God's call. May God find us faithful as overcomers of this world system. Father, give us your strength, for we need it to be victorious in this world, and we will be victorious in you, our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. Hymn number 400.